session number 24730, Real 9.
Mr. Boxall, Real 9. We're talking about your time on the finger position, part of 355, lower down on the right-hand side. And we're just looking at what life was like when you're in these positions. What about the daily routine? I mean, it may not be much different from it had been in the Second World War, but could you just run through us again
how it went? Same thing, very much the same. It was stand to half an hour before light till half an hour after it got light. You then sort yourself out clean, wash and shave, clean your weapons, generally tidy up round your in your slit trench or in your bunker, whichever you were in. Then there'd be breakfast. You'd have to come down in relays for breakfast because you couldn't all come down to have breakfast and leave the place unguarded. So that had to be organised. Some people came and some stayed, and then when they got back, the others came down. And then once that was all completed, it was then generally looking after the position, perhaps wiring, perhaps resting, ready to go out on patrol that night.
Well, that's two things I want to know. How was the wiring done? Because I understand wiring was quite important. Can you just tell us how the wiring was done, how it was laid out, and what the actual mechanics were?
Oh, well, yes.
Were you using Dannett wire, or what type of wire were you using? Were you using the screw pickets, or what?
Well, it was screw pickets that they used with Dannett wire, which was Dannett wire is a big roll of wire that you hit with a chunk of wood and knock it about until you spread it out and it opens out into a like a concertina, and then that is picked up and laid with the pickets fixed to the pickets. Perhaps you might be doing it three rolls high, so you put two rolls side by side, another roll on top, or you might have it five rolls high, so it'll be three on the bottom, two on top of them, one on top of that, and then that would all be held together with strands of ordinary barbed wire that run down to pickets and make an apron fence of it so that it's not very easy to penetrate.
How deep were you aiming to get it, and how many bands of this wire?
Well, we were usually used two. Too thick in at the bottom layer, so that would made it three rolls high or two rolls high.
And that would be about 3 foot across.
A bit more than that, because I suppose the Dannett wire rolls were a couple of foot, so it would be 4 foot wide.
And how many of these bands, or was there just one? I mean, would you have sort of layer, you know?
Well, it could be, as I say, it could be one, two, or three. It depends.
What I mean is not in one band. Was there more than one?
Yeah.
It depends.
If you were laying a minefield in front of it, then you would have a line of shingle wire, a minefield, and then Dannett wire. And that was generally the layout.
Did you have ways through it that you knew of?
Well, you had to have ways through because. When patrols went out, they had to have a safe way out and a safe way in.
Now, how was that done so that the Koreans or Chinese couldn't get through the same way?
Well, what you did was you had the safe walkway through, but then you made sure that was covered by an automatic weapon, so that if anyone sort of came through who wasn't meant to come through, you got a burst of fire instead. So. Whatever gaps there were left for our people to use were always most carefully, and that's where your sentries were posted in the slit trench, covering them at night.
Now, let's talk about the sentry rota. How was the sentry rota? Was it on all? Was there a sentry?
Well, that was done by their section commanders, platoon commander. Each section had their own little set of slit trenches. And then that was up to the section commander to organise his sentries for the night.
Would you have sentries on all day as well?
Yeah, well, they always had someone on in one of the forward slit trenches, probably covering the gap in the wire, and that's where he would. What you'd have a sentry on there all day.
So just one though. For the company.
Depends. For each platoon, perhaps.
And then at night there'd be more.
And then at night, yeah. Well, really, what happened was there'd be a patrol out, so they would be out the other side of the through the wire, on the other side of the wire, perhaps laying up.
I'll come to patrol. Would you check the night? I mean, I know you didn't set them because you were the company sergeant major, but would you check the platoons?
Wouldn't personally check the platoons, but I would, if the company commander wanted me to, go round and visit platoons during the night and see that things were being done. Because it wasn't always, you couldn't always rely on everybody to do everything dead right. And it was always wise to have a little check round to make sure things were going correctly, that people hadn't fallen asleep on their post or forgot, hadn't bothered to do anything.
So it's a sort of belt and braces.
Oh, yeah, approach. Yeah,
you
yeah.
had the platoon sergeant would be doing it, yeah, but you'd just check a bit.
Check them. The same with, it wasn't always, you can always say that the platoon commanders were doing everything right, because they were all young second lieutenants, most of them. They had to be, you had to sort of jolly them along as much as did some of the others. I mean, you see, I was, Ben Chapman and I were the oldest people in the company. In fact, one of the national servicemen said to me not long ago, you know, you were like our father. We looked on you as our father, because you were sort of 9 or 10 years older than we were. So, you know, you had to look after them, chivvy them along, make sure they were well fed. If there was any problem with the clothing or anything, you had to make sure that the colour sergeant got a grip of it and sorted it out.
So generally you tried to look after them?
Yeah, generally. The job of the company sergeant major is to look after them, discipline, make sure things are running, and help the company commander as much as you can.
Now, what about the patrols? What different types of patrols were sent out? How involved would you be in it?
I wouldn't be involved in them at all, other than being in the company command post, assisting the company commander, who'd be running the wireless net with a signaller.
That's a good point, actually, I should have read. What was the company command post? Could you describe what it was, who would be there, and what equipment
was? It was a rather largish bunker, and in it would be the company commander, his signaller, with the signal setter, with the wireless sets and telephones, because we had telephone wires laid on to it, down to battalion headquarters and to other companies along the line. There would be perhaps a company commander's batman, if he was required. I'd be in there, generally supervising if I was needed, or I'd be out going round the company positions, making sure things were running right. In one place that we were at, my bunker was used as the aid post for the MO, and he used to come up every night and occupy my bunker, and any casualties or anything came in were looked after by him in my bunker, because it was rather a fairly large bunker, the last one that I was in.
You'd be in the that was the thing with the company. Now, what about the patrols? What patrolling activity were you aware of going on?
There were always patrols out every night.
What types of patrols?
There'd be ones that went up and went out and laid up as a listening patrol, see if they could make sure that we didn't get attacked or anything at night. There were other patrols that went out as fighting patrols, and they went out definitely looking for the enemy to see if they could, perhaps capture a prisoner or at least cause some problems. And they were quite patrolling every night. It wasn't always just by a company. Other companies used to do it. A lot of patrols used to come out through a company, because we were the leading forward company.
On the finger.
Yeah. And at other places that we were at. Now, after Finger, we moved in to the Samichon Valley.
I think...
That 238 Hill, the battalion finally came together after we'd been detached onto to the Cosbys. They then the battalion a day or so later moved up into onto the line, and 238 was a hill that they occupied. Just after we moved onto this finger position, the Cosbys, I think it was, were attacked by the Chinese, and they told us that we didn't have to worry about aircraft or artillery, because the Chinese didn't have any artillery or didn't have any very much aircraft. I don't know what it was they were using to attack the Cosbys with, but by Christ, they had some guns there. The place was completely covered with shell bursts, and they took that hill eventually, the Chinese, and then...
Which is it, Hill 355?
One that was forward of us, that the Cosbys were occupying.
That was
the one where the chap won his VC. Can't think of his name.
It's gone from my mind as well, but the Londoner.
He was a Scotsman.
Oh, right, no, I don't know.
He's a bit of a waste.
Speakman.
That's him. Seaman or
Speakman.
Speakman, that's him, yeah. Yeah. So we sort of saw all that, but then the battalion finally moved up and became a battalion once again, and we were still up in the front in the line. A Company seemed to be unfortunate that every time we went up into the line, we were always one of the forward companies. But we were never one of the reserve companies, I don't know why. Perhaps they liked us.
So after this, that was on the 4th of November, yeah, 4th, 5th of November.
Yeah,
And then about a week later we moved. Back.
Yeah, we moved back. We moved down onto the Samichon. And there we really began to patrol and dig ourselves in, made...
Could you describe the terrain in the Samichon Valley? Was it different from up
there? No, it was... We were on the hill. In front of us was a large valley with a river running along it. And once again, it was slip trenches on the forward face, living quarters and everything else around the back end, around the back of the hill. And we all had bunkers. They all had fires in. One platoon used to regularly go forward to a little village, getting wood for their fires. And one day they went out. I didn't know, but they obviously went out unarmed or anything. Went to this little village and there was a burst of fire, and up got about 20 North Koreans and carted off two of them. A chap called Corporal Ashton and a Private Pantrini. And away across the valley they went. But luckily, the RA were having a practice shoot, and we managed to get it switched. And whilst this stonk, as they called it, came down on the Chinese, Joe Ashton managed to hit the North Korean who was looking after him, and Pantrini over the head with a rock, and scarpered quick. And they both got away and came back. But that taught us not to go wood in without being properly protected. And that I think that taught them a lesson. But generally, all of them, whether they were young regular soldiers or whether they were national servicemen, they all did their job. I rather admire the national servicemen in the end, because although they didn't want to be there, although half of them weren't old enough to leave their mum hardly, they all buckled in and did their job, and they were a good lot to serve with.
Now, what about the effect? I mean, we mentioned briefly winter, you know, the cold.
Oh,
Tell me, here you're really hitting. You went there in November and you were there for 2 or 3 months.
We were there right through the winter.
What was the cold like?
Oh, look, it was cold. It froze up about November and it stayed frozen until about March. And we had ropes up the side of the hill to try and help yourself get up them, up the hill.
What was it like? I mean, how did you try and cope with the cold? How did you try and keep warm?
Once again, we all had fires in our bunkers, so that was all right.
Were you aware of the risks of fires and stoves? In
bunkers? As long as you kept warm, didn't matter.
I mean, did they know about you need ventilation as well?
Oh, well, no, people didn't bother about that. Or if you're flaming cold, you don't know about ventilation, I'll tell you. But we had windproof clothing.
What clothing did you have? What would you wear in December?
We would wear long pants, because we had issued long pants, windproof trousers, a windproof jacket, a cardigan underneath, then a windproof jacket. And then if you were out and actually working in the bad weather, you'd have a parka on, which was a heavy padded jacket with a hood. And most of the time I didn't wear my parka, although I was out in the cold. You get used to it, so you don't need, only on exceptional occasions that I wore my parka.
I mean, how bad was it?
Oh, it was bad enough that you left your weapons outside. You didn't take your weapons into your bunker, because if you did, when you went outside, they froze up, and we had to have special oil for all the machine guns and for the Bren guns and that, and they had to remain outside. We made little racks in the slip trench for the weapons to be put into, so they kept out in the cold weather and didn't freeze up when they were needed to be used. Oh, it was cold, but fortunately we never had anyone who was actually who got frostbite or was any problem. We did have one patrol go out one night, and when they came in, they found that they were one man short. And the next morning, they went out, and he was laying beside the River Samichon with a bullet through the middle of his head. He'd been hit in an exchange of fire that night.
Now, how much? I should have mentioned perhaps. How much fighting was it? Could you describe?
Well, there was quite a bit in the Samichon Valley, because patrols went out. And there was always, if patrols were out, there was always a problem with patrols meeting up and firing at each other and laying ambushes. And so there was quite a bit. And one or two of our company patrols got caught out, or caught some North Koreans out, or Chinese.
Do you remember any details?
Well,
you wouldn't be on them, so I understand.
No, not really. All I know was when they came in, and perhaps the lieutenant who'd been commanding the patrol had been sort of fairly wet in the river, and when he came in, his jacket was frozen all down the front, and the zip was frozen solid, so we had to stand him in front of the fire to thaw him out a bit before he could get out of his jacket.
What was the procedure with casualties? Can you run through it?
Yes. This one, for instance, who had been killed, they went out to get him in. The company commander went out in the end. They got a stretcher bearer, the medical corporal. We had a medical corporal with the company. He went out with the company commander and a patrol. They got this chap on the stretcher and brought him in. And the MO came along to certify him as dead. Then he was packed off down to Aeson to be sent on further down to Pusan for burial.
That's where they were buried?
Yeah, at the military cemetery in Pusan. Now, we had a couple of people missing. And one of them, it was 10 days later that he was found in a slip trench, dead. The medical corporal had to get in the slip trench to get him out, which wasn't a very pleasant job for him, I don't suppose. But then the other one, he'd been out a fortnight, and he'd been hit by a shell or something, and it blown his head off. and he was laying in his slip trench, and the medical corporal had to get in and get him out. And he was brought in. The MO, they got him in fairly late in the evening, and the MO sort of said, well, we can't obviously keep him in here during the night. So I said, what I'll do, I'll put it, put a blanket in, smother it in creosote, and put him in on the Jeep and take the Jeep outside the wire down the road a bit and leave it there for the night. And that's what they did until the next morning when they could take him down to Ayrshire and get him away to Pew Sands.
None of them were buried locally? They were all
No, they all went down to the military cemetery at Pew Sands.
Now, what about the wounded? What happened to them?
Wounded? Well, it then depended. If they were not lightly wounded, they were evacuated by Jeep or by ambulance. If they were fairly badly wounded, they'd get the Americans to bring in a helicopter. And they had these rather basic helicopters. And what they did, they fitted a box on the undercarriage, on the tubular undercarriage. And there they used to put the poor bloke who was wounded in his box, like a coffin, and take off and fly them down to the military hospital. I didn't fancy the idea myself, but I was fortunate I was never hit, so. But in that respect, it was better than, and it was quicker than, and a lot of people's lives were saved, I suppose, by using helicopters. I think that was the first time they actually used helicopters for medical evacuation.
What about, was there much shell fire, Chinese or
Not a lot. We used to have the RA used to shoot for us.
Royal Artillery.
Royal Artillery. In fact, we had a chap called a forward observation officer from the RA, a captain, I can't remember his name, but he came up to us and I said to him, I think I know you. And he said, do you? I said, yeah. Last time I saw you, you were up a tree in Normandy with a matlow down below you, directing fire from HMS Warspite. It was under command. And he said, you're right, I was. He said, I was forward officer bombardment. I said, yes, I know. And we used to sit and chat about Normandy quite often in the evenings.
And what was his job exactly?
Well, he was the officer who came up from the Royal Artillery and organised them shoots. Like, if we wanted to put a shell fire down onto a slit trench or onto a set of trenches or on a hill, he was there to sort of organise it and tell the guns where they were going, dropping short or overshooting and correcting the ranges. And he sort of generally told the RA about what they couldn't see.
And what about your own fire plans? I mean, I should have asked. Well, we had defensive fire plans. Do you know what I mean?
We had machine guns. We had machine guns from machine gun platoon up with us. They obviously had the mortar platoon, which was situated behind us, and we had a sergeant of the mortar platoon who could come up and sort of direct their fire. And of course, all the slit trenches were sighted so they could cover each other and cover the anything to the front.
Did they actually have a plan for, you know, you could call for defensive fire and they would drop a curtain in front of you, or that sort of thing?
No, because you depended on the forward observation officer for that.
No, I mean your mortars or your machine.
Oh, the mortars, yes. Well, they had their drawings set out and their ranges and everything, and they could immediately call up fire onto certain points. They could say, you know, farmhouse, 8 o'clock, whatever range it was, and they could fire fairly straight away.
Did you get a? I mean, was there much sniping, or it sounds like your casualties were mainly in no man's land.
Yeah, mainly the casualties were in patrolling.
When patrols ran into
trouble, yeah. I had one chap killed in A Company when a shell landed beside him in the, when he was in his strip trench, and that killed him. As I say, we had one killed on the Samichon when they were out on patrol. And then near the end of our touring career, we lost one or two when they went out on a fight a patrol to catch a prisoner, and they were caught instead.
Yeah, well, we'll come to that. Yeah. So, but so there wasn't much sort of harassing shellfire or anything like that.
No. But of course, you had to keep. There was no good inviting them to fire. Actually, you didn't stand out on the hill and wave to them. If you moved about, you moved about fairly circumspectly, and you kept as much undercover as you could.
Now, in sort of mid-December, you went out the line for 5 days to Pakhoik Reservoir.
Reservoir, yeah.
That was a sort of the reserve camp. What was the camp like there?
Well, it wasn't anything exceptional, because I can't remember what it was like. But whilst we were there, we had to do a practice attack on a hill. Night attack on a hill, because they were practicing to do an attack on a hill near the San Michon Valley, but that never came off. But
what was the practice attack like?
Well, you had to go up this hill in the middle of the night, mainly up through the communication trenches. Mortars and machine guns were firing overhead, and it was, as I say, a practice to perfect the way of doing it.
You then went back into the line, into the same position,
I think. Yes, we went back into the San Michon Valley again.
Just before Christmas.
Yeah.
And, it looks to me like the incident where you mentioned about the patrol was Private Watkins, the chap who was killed in No Man's Land. Now, what about the arrangements for Christmas? Because I know you've got some points to make about
Christmas, yeah. We did the best we could. We had a tent for a dining room. We found some old doors and bits of wood and made tables and sort of benches that they could sit at. And the Christmas dinner was a Christmas dinner as much as they could make. Christmas pudding, turkey, and all the bits and pieces. But of course we were in the line, so you couldn't get everybody in the tent to sit down together. They had to come in as they could. After Christmas, the second in command of the company was up in the CP talking to Major Chapman, and he said, I wasn't very happy about the arrangements for Christmas, Ben. I had done most of the work towards it, and that made me a bit annoyed. And my comment was, well, you should have let him well come up here and done the job yourself. Is that part of the job that you're supposed to do, instead of sitting on your backside in a restaurant? And with that, I got up and walked out. And afterwards, I said to Major Chapman, I'm sorry, but I think he got a bloody hard neck to come up here and say he wasn't very satisfied with the arrangements for Christmas, when he did sod all, and him and the colour sergeant did nothing at all towards organising the thing as they should have done. The other people were supposed to do the admin of the company, not me. And
they were at A Echelon.
They were at A Echelon.
Were they doing?
Well, they were down at A Echelon, obviously enjoying themselves in the sergeant's mess they had down there, and the officer's mess they had down there, and taking life easy. Well, and we were doing all the blooming work. And I didn't think that was on.
And you felt they weren't actually doing what they should
do? No, they weren't carrying out the job that they were meant to do. I mean, the 2IC of the company is supposed to be the officer who looks after the admin of the company. And the colour sergeant is a man who looks after the admin of the company under the 2IC. And it's a colour sergeant's job to see that the food is cooked. It's a colour sergeant's job to see that there's a cookhouse. But I did all that for them.
Did they come forward regularly, the secret?
Well, they came up every day with the rations and with stuff for them from the nappy, but they weren't there very long before they scarpered back to Aeslon.
So they were doing the stuff about the cooking facilities, the rest of it?
No, they should have been up on the position most of the time and gone back to Aeslon at night. But that was how they worked it, but I didn't mind, because I quite enjoyed running the cookhouse and making sure things were working properly, but I did object to being criticised about something that they should have done themselves. And I was in no uncertain terms.